Om Shanti. Everybody getting okay? So now I go on an assumption. Good morning, welcome, thank you very much for coming. And I think you all know the subject of our time this morning. It is one of our favorite emotions. And it's an emotion that I guess has to come. Although we put it under the umbrella of one of the five vices. And as Brahmins, we're not meant to experience vice. We are the viceless ones, as you all know. And therefore, we are following Baba's instructions very well. And we are all free of all the vices. And therefore, our friend anger never comes, does it? You never get angry, do you? Shall I ask that question again? Are you? Yeah. Very good. Very good. Innocent. And of course, there is nothing more inevitable, I think, than at some stage, if not in regular stages, that anger must emerge in our consciousness. It's part of the price that we pay for our mistakes yesterday, and very much a part of our journey, our spiritual journey, is understanding what the anger is, why we create it, and how to transform it. So I thought this morning might be a good chance to really explore deeply what anger is exactly, why it happens, and how to be free. And because I know you've been doing a lot of listening, and if not to morning classes, then classes during the day, and daddies and Merleys, and I thought it might be quite nice to start by allowing you to do some talking. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. And the first question is, what is anger? How would you define it? And the second question is, why do we become angry? Why does anger happen? Yeah. Easy questions, really. And just an excuse to make your brain cells move a little, and also an excuse to speak to someone. And so with somebody next to you, preferably in your own language, have a little discussion and see if you can arrive at a decision. What is anger, and why do we create it? Why do we actually manufacture this emotion? Yeah? Everybody understand? Did everybody else hear the question? Yes? See? We? Yes? Uh-huh. This means yes? Yep. So, with someone next to you, have a little conversation. Hello, good morning, how are you? What is anger? And why do you create it? Why do we create it? Fantastic. Everybody's fully awake and aware now. There was about 3 months ago in the UK, in one of the big Sunday newspapers, they did a very big supplement. And the supplement, it's about 15, 20 pages long. And the title of the supplement was We Now Live in the Age of Rage. And this particular newspaper had done this massive survey into the levels of anger in society. And they'd found that in every area of society, in the UK, and I guess it's a good example for the world. The level of anger is rising exponentially. And they looked in various professions, the level of anger in the medical profession and level of anger in airline passengers. Definitely on the roads. You all heard of something called road rage. Do you have road rage? Yes. And now we don't just have road rage, we have something called trolley rage. Yeah, and this is a speciality of the superstore, and you're going around to get your groceries. You buy your groceries, and as you're driving your trolley, people get trolley rage because there's not enough space, and other people's trolleys are too slow, and then of course the new phenomena in the world today is something called net rage. You know when you're sitting at your computer and the computer just hangs for a moment. It just stops for a moment, doesn't it? And what happens to your teeth? They start to grit, don't they? And the moment that tension arrives on your face, it means the anger in relation to the computer or the technology is beginning to emerge. So it's official, basically, that we now live in the age of rage. And the underlying reason this particular survey discovered was the cause of the increase in anger was a combination of two things. One of them is speed, in as much that the world is just getting faster and faster and faster. Driven, of course, by technology. And the other thing is, combined with speed, is that people generally feel they're not getting what they want fast enough. Yeah. And of course, technology is the main protagonist, the main medium to communicate to us all that we should be getting more because everybody else is getting more. And we should be able to now get exactly what we want because no other generation in the world has had so much available to them almost instantly at the press of a button. And of course, this raises something called expectations so high in the world today, just in terms of consuming solid goods, consuming foods, consuming holidays, the consumption of everything. People's expectations are so high. And when they don't get what they want as fast as they think they should get it, then they become very upset, very angry. And I think it's applicable to us, but perhaps at a different level. I don't know if you've ever noticed that whenever you want something, you already have it. Yeah? Whenever you want something, you already have it. It's already there on the screen of your mind. You know, the object of your desire has already been acquired on the screen of your mind. And then when it doesn't show up in physical reality, when it doesn't arrive from outside in, then the image you have of it on the screen of your mind doesn't become a reality, then that's when we become a little bit upset. And the upsetness, of course, begins with just the seed of anger. The seed of anger is something called irritation. And there's a little irritation. And if we attend to, if I give my attention to the irritation that kind of grows, it's like putting water in a plant. The irritation grows into frustration. And then the frustration grows into anger. Sometimes we talk about five vices. And we name our five vices: ego, attachment, lust, greed, anger. But really, there's only one vice. So it's just one vice. And it's this idea of the ego. And to understand where anger comes from, I'd need to understand how the ego operates, how it creates itself, and how it creates emotion. Because all emotion actually emerges from the ego. And I guess that's why we're here, really, to see and understand, to be aware of what happens when I have a desire for anything, for food, to be with someone, to go somewhere, to acquire something. Whatever the desire is, I create the image of that desire on the screen of my mind. Yeah, that's the kind of first step of awareness, really. Whatever it is, even if it's just I want someone to behave in a certain way, I create as I want. I create the image of what I want as I desire. Yeah. But then the next step is the step where it really kind of goes wrong. Is that I then lose my sense of self. The I that says I am, I lose my sense of I, myself, in the image that I create. In other words, I lose myself in my mind, not just in my mind, but in the image that's on my mind. I lose my sense of self in my creation. And so I identify with the object of my desire, which I've created on the screen of my mind. Now, if I receive a little bit of news or something happens to inform me that my desire is not going to be fulfilled, or I get evidence from the world around me that my desire is not being fulfilled, then I create a disturbance in my consciousness. Yeah. The precursor to anger is always another emotion. Don't know if you can see it. It's another emotion. It might just be momentary, but it's always there. Before the anger emerges, there's always a moment of sadness. And sadness always accompanies a sense of loss, a sense that I have lost something. Yeah, and the sadness, it can last a long time and eventually turn into anger, or it can last just for a moment and very quickly it turns as I look for someone to blame for my sense of loss, which really is my unfulfilled desire. Yeah. Even though I don't have in physical reality what I desire mentally, it's as if I have it in my mind. If it doesn't show up, it means I've lost what I thought I had. Yeah. And there's a moment of sadness. And that sadness just turns, it then turns into anger, as I look for someone or something to blame. Now, it's impossible to be angry for a long time. I mean, consistently angry. I don't know if you ever tried this. Have you ever tried to be angry? See, some of you are laughing already. And if you try to deliberately be angry, you will start laughing eventually, because you realize it's impossible and it's silly and it's a waste of time. So what usually happens once the anger begins to die, once it begins to die, as it must subside in time, you can't keep it up, is it turns again, and it turns into fear. Yeah, because now I have the experience of loss, the experience of my rage, and that's painful, and now it turns into the fear that it may happen again. It may happen again. And so I create fear. And that's why if you look at these three emotions, you'll see them in terms of time. Sadness and anger are always of the past, and fear is always of the future in terms of our sense of time. And so I have a nice little cycle going now, which is sadness, anger, fear, sadness, anger, fear. And the root of that cycle is the ego, which is attachment to an image in my mind which I identify with. That's what the ego is. And when something happens to that image, or it's not fulfilled, then I create a disturbance in my consciousness. And that disturbance is called emotion. That's what emotion is. Energy in motion. And that's why all emotion has its roots in attachment, which is the same as the ego. Can you see it? Yeah. Now, of course, in the world outside, it's very, very hard for people to see and to understand this. In fact, I remember giving a short talk about 2 years ago to a group of philanthropists. Philanthropists? That should do. Philanthropists. People with a lot of money whose purpose in life was to give money away to help other people. And at one stage in the conversation that I had with these people, I was asking them why they do this. And at some stage in them answering the question why they give their money away to help others, someone said, well, I'm trying to right some of the wrongs in the world. I'm trying to correct some of the injustices. Because I'm angry. I'm angry. And this is my way of trying to fix it. And at that point, I kind of suggested as a good BK does, I was just kind of suggesting that maybe it's not a good idea to get angry. And maybe it's counterproductive. And this was like throwing a fire on a rag soaked in petrol. And the whole room went up in flames for the next 1 hour and a half, as we had this very, very intense conversation about the rightness, the usefulness, the appropriateness of anger. And it was this particular conversation that actually inspired me to go away and write. And so the book on anger that's just come out is really dedicated to this group of people. And one of the realizations I had in this conversation that I had with them is that as they were showing me their anger, as I was suggesting that anger is not a very good thing, I realized I was watching or sitting in the midst of a room full of drug addicts. Because anger is a drug. It's a drug. And this is why it's very hard for people in the world to see how counterproductive, how dangerous it is. I don't know if you know someone. I think I've met a few people in my life who spend a lot of their time looking for reasons to be offended. You know, it's as if in a conversation they're looking for a reason to argue, to disagree, to have a little verbal sophisticuffs, so they have the excuse to create the emotion of anger, both mentally and physically. And this is their way of getting their hit, their little drug. And a little sort of, what the body, if you get angry emotionally, then what does it create in the body? It creates adrenaline and cortisol, two chemicals apparently. And if you keep creating these chemicals, eventually they will physically kill you. The scientists know this now. And so that's one level of the addiction. But the real level of the emotional addiction is again, it comes back to our old friend, the ego. I don't know if you remember the first few times you become emotional about anything. You know, there's like a very distinct, alive feeling of aliveness in your consciousness. Even in a state of sorrow, there's a kind of aliveness there. And that aliveness, it becomes something that we then identify with. You know, our identity doesn't just become invested in things, and of course, for us, body consciousness is our primary identity, but it becomes invested in the emotions that we create. You hear this sometimes when people say, "Do you know I'm a bit of a worrier? You know, I've worried a lot. I've worried all my life. Yeah, I am a bit of a worrier. I guess it's just my nature. Yeah, yeah. Mom and Dad worried, and it's probably genetic. I'm a worrier." And you can sense this urge to identify with the emotion. Yeah. And so it's like in the interactions with other people. People look for ways to create the emotion to affirm their identity, which is based in the emotion. Do you recognize that at all? Yeah? Yeah. And of course, then it's not just an addiction, it's a dependency. It's a real dependency. Because to give up the emotion, to agree that it's not good to get angry in any way, or it's not good to get sad in any way, or it's bad to be scared in some way, is like death. It's like I have to die because my identity is invested at this emotional level in my emotions. And that's why for most people in the world out there to suggest that it's not a good idea is to suggest that it's time you died. And that doesn't go down too well. So, we know that we've been on a journey, and we know that on that journey our companion has been our old friend the ego. And that means we've created many sanskaras, and those sanskaras of sadness, of anger and fear, they're all nicely interlocked within our consciousness, within our subconscious, the unconscious area of our consciousness. And so we arrive at this point now, understanding very consciously that the cause of our anger is completely self-created. It's not anyone else. I'm kind of assuming you know that. I'm making this assumption, by the way. I'm not covering this ground because I assume that you realize that whenever you do get a little irritated, frustrated, angry, that you create it. You're okay with that? That you never project it out onto anyone or anything else? No. Is that true? Yeah? Yeah? Because it is entirely self-created, isn't it? And so I'm assuming that you're now in a space where you take full responsibility for any feelings, irritation, frustration, anger. And therefore, the work of transformation, in a sense, has begun. And it might well be that I could walk through a day, and especially in Madhuban, where it's quite easy to do this, it's much easier than anywhere else, it's a great place to practice most of the time, I can walk through my day and not react emotionally to anyone or anything, because that's what emotion does, it reacts. So this is a place where I can go through the day and find it easy not to react. But still, there seems to bubble to the surface the irritation, the feelings of frustration, the feeling that I'm angry about something, but I don't know what it is. I can't see what it is. And that's because in our subconscious there is a huge residue of our creation, this birth, last birth, many births, miscreation, the ego's creation, already recorded in layer after layer after layer. This is why also sometimes when you're on your spiritual journey, maybe 5 years, maybe 6 years, 10 years, sometimes even 25 years, you might hear some spiritual aspirants, spiritual pilgrims say, you know, it was amazing. I 10 years ago, I suddenly felt I was free of all my anger. I was free of all my negativity. I was free of projecting onto others. It was gone. And you know what? Yesterday, I did it again. And I thought it had gone. And you hear this, and it feels as if you're free. But then something triggers that huge amount that lives within our unconscious. And it has to come to the surface. It has to come up. It's okay. It's okay. So some people, when we hear our spiritual lessons at just a kind of intellectual level, saying, five vices, very bad, shouldn't be angry, I shouldn't be upset, I should be peaceful and loving and pure all the time. And of course what we do is we create this ideal image of what it means to be a Brahman, what it means to be on my spiritual journey. And I create this ideal image. And in fact, what I don't realize is that I'm just creating another image to which I'm becoming attached and identifying with. And then one day a little ripple comes from my subconscious, you know, that disturbs my consciousness, a little frustration. And before I know it, I'm going, oh my God, I'm a terrible BK. I failed again. I'm not doing very well. I'm a failure. And I sabotage myself. And the reason? I had the ideal image to which I became attached. And so I was trying to idealize my spiritual life instead of realize my spiritual life. Yeah, I was living in an idealization. And that is what blocks my realization. Yeah. Because to be real is to understand that these emotions are recorded inside and they have to come up to the surface. Every one of us, we will have to feel them and we will have to transform them. I have to. And to suggest otherwise is not healthy, because to idealize and suggest otherwise will make me do the most dangerous thing when they do come. They'll make me want to suppress them, to deny them, to push them back down again. And I'll begin to resist the emotion that I'm feeling. And if I resist the emotion that I feel, remember, I have emotions and I feel those emotions. If I resist them because they don't fit the ideal I have of my spiritual perfect self, then I just suppress them and strengthen them further. So they must come. And so what do I do when they come? How do I deal with the buried, recorded result of my ego for how many births? Wow. So I have a little plan, a little procedure. Michelle, can I just do this and then I will hear you? Yeah, can I just finish? Oh, okay, go on then. Did everybody hear that? No. What Michelle is just trying to clarify is that he's got the impression that I'm saying that it's not good to idealize. And he's saying, is it not okay to have an ideal image of what I would like to be? But the mistake comes when I attach to that ideal image. And in a sense, yes, and in a sense, no, for me personally. For me, when you create the image, it's very difficult not to get attached to your creation. And so if I'm not attached to the creation of an ideal image, for example, my ideal house, I've got this image of my ideal house, and of course I get very attached to it. Until I find the house outside that fits that image, I will not be content in myself. And so I have an ideal image of how I should be in my spiritual life. And is it okay to have that image and not be attached to it? I think it's very difficult not to get attached to your creation. And for me, I might create the image, but I'm interested in dropping it the moment I create it. I drop it the moment I create it. I drop it the moment I create it. Because then I'm totally open. I'm totally open to whatever is coming from inside to deal with that. And that for me is, yeah, detachment. That's what detachment is. Now, Baba tells us that, and I think this is one of the basic understanding of our spiritual journey, is that we already are all that we can be. We already are our perfect selves. We already are all that we've ever been. And that can never be changed. And so how do I allow that to come back into reality? Yeah. How do I allow that to come back into my consciousness and manifest in my life? And for me, the only way to allow that to happen is not to have anything block that process on the inside. Now, if I've got an ideal image, that means I've got an image on my mind. That means I'm doing a lot of thinking. And if I've got that image for more than one or two moments, it means I keep thinking about it. My energy keeps affirming it, keeps bringing it up. This is what I should be. This is what it should be like. This is what it should be like. It's what I should be doing, what I should be feeling, what I should be. And so that for me is how I block the emergence of the authentic self, my true self, which is always there. In fact, I can't see it, because my energy is going and thinking about the ideal. Even though I might be detaching and creating and detaching and creating, I'm still thinking about what it might be instead of allowing it to come through. And that for me is really the first step of dealing with what does come through. And it's like this idea of awareness, just being aware. So how do I deal with the emotions as they come up, as they're triggered, as they have to be by the drama outside, by my sanskaras inside? How do I deal with this energy that disturbs me, that clouds me? And the first step is awareness. How aware am I of what I am feeling, of the emotions that I'm feeling? Am I able to read my own emotions? You know that emotions are just like, they're like symbols. Just as you read a book, you see words on a page. And words are just symbols. That's all they are. The meaning is not in the words. The meaning is something you create when you use the symbols of the words. That's why one person reads a sentence, has a different meaning to another person. We are creators of meaning. And so we're not so interested in words and books, but we're very interested in what we feel, the meaning of certain feelings, the meaning of certain thought patterns. And so am I aware and able to read my emotions? Do I know what irritation is? Can I read frustration in my attitude? Can I be aware of the subtle forms that anger takes within me? This is learning to read myself as that energy comes up. And then when I recognize the emotion is present, a little irritation, for example, do I acknowledge it? Second step is to acknowledge it. In other words, have I freed myself of the sanskar of projecting it onto someone else? Yeah. And this is quite challenging, I guess, even for us, because one of the deepest sanskars we've created in our lives is this idea that someone else is responsible for what I feel. Yeah. And in psychological terms, this means to cast my shadow into the world. The shadow is the emotional disturbance, and we cast it out and we blame someone else for the emotion that I'm feeling. And this is exactly what's going on in the world today. You know, from our leaders, our Bushies, our Blairs and so on, right down all the levels of society. Everyone is casting the shadow of their created emotions into the world. And as they project those emotions outwards, then they get them reflected back by the world around them. And so you have projection and reflection in the world around us, and that's what creates what we're watching right now. The resolution of the unconscious emotions in the human story, in the form of war. Yeah, in the form of, I guess, this time in history, the end time. Yeah, this is what's the cause of it. It's the unconscious emotional state projected onto others, reflected back, and that's what's causing the conflict in the world. And it's okay. It's fine. It's also how it's being transformed. It's how it's being resolved. And it's the worst way to transform, the worst way to resolve, but it's how it's happening. And the reason we're here is we've chosen to do it another way. Instead of projecting it onto someone else, we take step number two and realize the responsibility. We acknowledge I am the creation of my own darkness, my own disturbance. And that's because of the ego, which we now understand. So the third step, as these waves of old emotion comes up, is not to resist, but to accept the emotion. Aha, irritation, you're back again. I thought you'd gone. You're here again. Fantastic. Welcome back. Yeah, it sounds crazy, but this is why I meditate. It's in the process of meditation I begin to say, hey, there's me and there's the emotion. And then process of meditation, this is real detachment. There's me and there's the emotion. And the moment I have a conversation with the emotion that I feel, I'm acknowledging there's me and there's the emotion. I'm separating. And as I separate from the darkness of my emotion, I cast my light upon it. And it's like if you come into a room full of darkness and you shine a light, the darkness will disappear. And so I don't run away from the emotion. I don't suppress it. I don't repress it. I accept it. And the moment I accept it and begin to have a conversation with it, there's me and there's the emotion. And you'll notice in that practice that all emotion dies under observation. All emotion dies under observation. It has to. Because the emotion is our darkness and the observation is our light. And the light dissolves the darkness. And this is the moment the healing takes place. Because it's as if I'm integrating the darkness into the light of my consciousness. Where before I was rejecting, pushing away, avoiding, and possibly even being fearful of looking, and therefore adding to the darkness. Now I turn to face, to look, to see. And then step number four, which you're already doing really here, is to ascend, to rise above, to go away, to detach. Sometimes the phrase to helicopter out. It's a nice image. You get a little helicopter and go away from it. Look at it. Don't run away. I go away. I go away from it. And it goes away from me. Is that traffic control or is that just early? It's not yet. No. And then step number five is to attune, to attune. Yeah, to tune in, to attune. Don't know how that translates, to tune in. Tune in, you know in a radio, you tune the dial on the radio, to attune. When I'm emotional, it's like there's a hurricane in my head. You know, if you ever notice when you're emotional, when you're really, I don't know, it's like, you know, and there's like this energy going round inside. And the metaphor in the world outside is a hurricane. And, you know, weather patterns are brilliant reflectors of our sanskars, basically. And so in a hurricane in the world outside, the quietest place is in the center of the storm. That's where it is revolving around. That's where the peace and the power is emanating in that storm. The peace and the power. And so you know that to tune in to the center of your consciousness is where you always find your peace and your power. Yeah. And so the fifth step is to tune in, to reconnect with my peace and my power. Yeah, and that's meditation, really. Not just sitting down meditation, but in the meeting meditation, in the kitchen, in the car, in the conversation meditation, where somebody's pressing my button and I want to react. And no, I have to go through my, well, five steps. Awareness, acknowledge, accept, ascend, and attune. Now that sounds very logical, very linear, and very ideal. But I guarantee that today, when you sit with someone who you know kind of presses your buttons and you want to, you won't suddenly say, just hold on a second, I'm just on step three of my little plan here, can I just have a couple of minutes? I know you won't do that. I won't do that. I'll proceed to lose the plot, fight back a little, react, and then go away and regret. And so it's like the way I work with the process is retrospectively. as I look back on the encounter, whether or not, yes, I felt the irritation coming. I felt I was getting a bit angry, but yeah, and I didn't project it. I took responsibility. At least I did. Yet, no, I know why it got worse. It got worse because I tried to suppress it. That's what happened. That's what just got really all tangled and I lost my clarity. So I'll see the same person tomorrow because we see each other, same people, same day. So tomorrow, that's where I need to do my work. I need to not resist so much, but learn to work at the level of just accepting the emotion as it comes. Yeah. And so I use it in retrospect until I'm able to do it in real time, in the reality of real time. Yeah. And so this is a nice little kind of five-step process, which both helps me to understand the emotion and to heal it, to transform it. But the deepest spiritual method is always, and this is very hard. Hard is not the right word. It's very challenging for us. Because our conditioning, our way of learning in life, the one thing that we've never ever been taught, is to choose what we will feel. To choose our feelings. Yeah, to choose what we will feel. Most of the time, it's as if our feelings are chosen for us. Yeah, our feelings are something that comes from outside. And sometimes we even do it here. You know, oh, I love to be in Madhuban. I feel good in Madhuban. I feel nice here. I feel pleasant here. I feel I'm at home here. I feel everything's fine here. And so am I choosing to feel fine and okay? Or am I allowing the surroundings to impose themselves upon me and I'm just being washed along? Yeah, and then I'm not actually choosing what I feel. It's just another extension of going to the circus and watching a circus and going, oh, fantastic, great circus, I'm so excited, I feel great. Oh, Mum's going, are you excited and happy? I am happy and excited, Mum, yeah, I'm happy and excited. And that fatal moment when I'm a child, I learn that excitement equals happiness and that my feelings come from outside. Yeah, they don't. Feeling is something that I do, something that we do, not something that happens to us. Yeah. So anytime I say I'm feeling any emotion in that moment, it means I am not doing the work of feeling. The emotion has come up and it has got me in its grip. Yeah. And the three families of emotion you now know. Three families of emotion: sadness, anger, and fear. Yeah. Family of sadness is melancholy, powerlessness, hopelessness, inadequacy, depression. This is the family of sadness. Family of anger: irritation, frustration, resentment, hate, rage. Can you see that? And then the family of fear, worry, anxiety, tension. You can get them into these categories. And whenever those emotions come, good to read them, but be aware that in those moments, I am not consciously choosing what I feel. And that's why the spiritual solution is the practice of consciously feeling. My peace, consciously feeling the love that lives in my heart, consciously feeling the joy that springs from my heart, consciously feeling those things. If I'm not consciously feeling, choosing those feelings, then I'm still a slave to my emotions. You know, I'm still not reading, still not seeing, I'm still not healing my emotions. All the clocks are saying 12 o'clock, so I thought I'd feel my way into a moment of silence and to reconnect with the core of myself, my peace, the peace that's always there. But as I try to reach in and touch and feel that peace, what stops me? What gets in the way? Thoughts, and the thoughts that trigger certain emotions. Someone was sharing with me the other day that there was a little sorrow inside, and the words came, and you find this a lot. You find this phrase a lot in relation to certain emotions, and he said, "I am depressed. I am depressed." And that. Because I say I am depressed, this is the sign that my identity, my sense of identity, is lost in the emotion of depression. But that's not true. The truth is, there is I and there is the depression. Yeah. And how do I know that's true? Because the depression, it never stays. It comes and it goes. Just like the anger comes and goes. The irritation comes and goes. Thoughts come and go. Emotions come and go. But who always remains? Who's always there? Who never goes? The I that says, I am. The I that says, I am. Everything else comes and goes. Yeah, everything. Even the ideal will come and go. It has to, because the ideal is never real. The only thing that's real is the I that says, I am. Yeah. Michelle, I thought your hand might go up again. With self-respect. Someone asked me recently what the definition of self-respect, and in a sense, what is self-respect? And to respect myself, the same as to respect another, is to affirm, for me, to affirm the innate goodness and worth of the individual. To affirm the innate goodness. And another term for goodness is trueness. The innate goodness and worth of that individual. So when I respect you, when I listen and I give you a lot of respect, then I'm affirming in you your innate goodness, your trueness as a human being, and your worth, your value, if you like. And that's for me respect. That's not an ideal, that's an awareness, basically, of what I am. And I have that awareness in the context of relationship or the context of life. And as I affirm it in myself, then I can affirm it in the other. Yeah. But it's not a static thing. It's a dynamic thing. It changes its own color. Feels different every time I interact with you. The expression of my respect, the feeling of the respect that I have for you will be slightly different every time. It's not fixed and static. And that's what I mean by idealistic. Fixed, static. Has to be like this. It's dynamic. Yeah. Guilt. Guilt. The question is, what about guilt? Two kinds of guilt, really. Two kinds of guilt. And the guilt that other people want us to feel is otherwise known as emotional blackmail. You know, when the big person says to the little child, "You're so bad, you made a mistake, you're so wrong, you should feel so guilty." And it's as if they want us to suffer for what they perceive as a mistake. So that's one kind of guilt, which is obviously not healthy, but very much the currency of many cultures, and very much the tool of manipulation, both in the family and in the organization. And that's why I come here, to cut through all that, to see this clearly and find the power not to allow myself to be manipulated by that kind of projected guilt of another. Then the other kind of guilt is the guilt that comes when I act against my conscience. You know, and what is the conscience? The conscience is an awareness of absolute truth, of what is absolutely true. You know, it's my connection to what is true. Not only is our nature to be peaceful, to be a source of love, but is to be a point of truth in life. And so when I act against what is true, I hear a grating sound. Just like, you know, the carpenter acts against the grain of the wood. It's hard and it's tough and it makes a different sound and it doesn't happen smoothly. And so when I act against the truth, my conscience sends me a little message. And that message is the feeling of guilt that I've done something wrong. Now, this is where it gets very interesting, because the guilt really has its root in this idea. Again, it's like an idea that I've just separated from truth. Yeah, the separation. I've done something against the truth. I've done something wrong and the mistake, and there's the truth. And it's like I've separated. No longer am I going, no longer am I aligned to truth. I've come away. That's the feeling of guiltiness that's connected to this idea of separation. And this, the idea that the origin of guilt for a human being is the moment we separate from God. Yeah, the moment we turn our back and say, "No, I can do this on my own. I don't need you. I'm okay on my own." And there's this moment of separation. At least there's the illusion of separation. And this is the idea that separation from both my truth and from God is an illusion. Yeah. And if that's true, then guilt is an illusion too. But it's an illusion we create brilliantly and make ourselves suffer inside, create darkness inside. And then, when that darkness gets to a certain level, we go bleh on someone outside, either individually or collectively. And that's when people, in the extreme sense, go to war. Yeah, it's just their darkness, which is based on an illusion, emerging into the light of day to be resolved. Two ways to resolve it: go inside, realize the truth, or go bleh and have it exposed collectively to the truth of life. And so either way it gets resolved. One's very violent outside, and the other one is, there's a little bit of violence inside to unravel, but it's much gentler inside. And we've just chosen to do it the inner way. And so ultimately, if you see it, all these emotions, they all emerge from the ego. And the ego is, and I'll do this again, attachment to and identification with something that I'm not. You okay with that? So therefore, this identity is an illusion. It's an illusion. It's not real. It's unreal. And therefore, everything that comes from that identity is unreal. So that means all those emotions are unreal. They feel real, but their origin is in unreality, in illusion, maya. But they feel as if they're real. Yeah. But they become an illusion when I learn to feel reality. Have I suitably confused you? Yes, thank you, she said. Did you see it? Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah. Accepting and ascending. Yeah. No, you're already doing it. As you accept something or someone, implicit in the acceptance is actually you and the emotion. So you're already coming away from it. You're already pulling beyond saying, there's me and the emotion. Before that, there's just the emotion. And it's just got me in its grip. It's got me in its... I'm lost in it. I'm lost in that disturbance. You're lost in the storm. But the moment you accept it, you're acknowledging there's it and there's you, and I'm doing the accepting of it. So I'm already coming away from it. I'm already ascending. I'm already detaching. Oh, if it keeps drawing you back, then you're not detaching. It's more likely you're re-identifying with it. You actually want to go back into it. And again, this is prevalent outside, and we come here to work on this. It is obviously, I'm going back in, and although it's uncomfortable to be in it, I'm actually quite comfortable being uncomfortable. Yeah. And the deepest aspect of that is I'm not just comfortable being uncomfortable, but I'm totally identified with it. I am an uncomfortable person. I might as well say that. I'm an uncomfortable person. And in fact, I'll look for confirmation of that in others. Isn't it true? Aren't you uncomfortable with me? No. Aren't you a bit uncomfortable? Because I'm a bit of an uncomfortable person, you know. Go on, tell me I'm a bit naughty. Tell me I'm not so good. Tell me I'm a bit... Because actually I kind of want to affirm that because my identity has been lost in that habitually over time. And so even though I'm coming away, oh, I want to go back in again. And it's like a drug, really. It's like a drug. Yeah. That's why this is a clinic. We're in a clinic here. No. This is the asylum. Somebody, yes. On a practical level, how and when is it important to communicate negative emotions? It's never, ever good to communicate negative emotions on a practical level. However, don't read into that to say that, oh, I shouldn't do that. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't. Again, it's this turning the gun on myself, this habit. For me, I mean, maybe I have to, probably still have a lot of learning to do here. But for me, when these things come up, I communicate best with me. That's why I'm here. That's why I come here. That's why I sit a lot of my life in silence, because that's who I want to communicate with. So I talk to me about this all the time. And of course, I talk to Baba about this all the time. That's why he's there. And so the conversation's with me and him, between me and him. And it, for me, it's practically never good to talk to someone else. If you must talk to someone else about these things, then you know the person to go and talk to. And she's a great listener. And the reason she's a great listener is she's totally, kind of almost totally unaffected by any emotional state that you will communicate. And that's Daddy Janky. and of course the senior sisters, because their whole life training is to be able to listen and not carry away in their heart someone else's emotional state. One of the reasons why we don't sit in circles here, did you know why we don't sit in circles very much? Why we sit facing? Because if we sit in circles and tell each other what we're feeling, what would we end up doing? We'd all end up going blah on each other. Yeah, and I'd hear 10 people's emotional state, and then I'd leave the interaction with 10 people's emotional state in my, oh, they're like that. Oh, I didn't realize they're feeling that. Oh, that's terrible. Oh, isn't that awful? Oh, I don't know how they're going to make progress. They're not doing very well. Do you know, and that all that will spiral, you know, until I'm able, strong enough to hear it and not give it life in me. And so that's one of the reasons why we don't sit in, because we don't come here for therapy. You know, therapists listen to someone's emotions. But the only therapist for us is Baba and ourselves. You know, and as you listen, you read. You listen and you, now I understand. That's where it's coming. You listen and you read your own state. And so that's why communication with myself is the most practical. That's why Baba says, talk to yourself. And my way of doing that is I write. I scribble. I write and I scribble and I write and I scribble. You'll see me writing. It's the only reason I write. I'm talking to myself. Right now, I'm talking to myself. As Jenty was saying last night, you know, she was giving a class the other day, and she realized that as she was giving the class was entirely for her. You know, everything we say for ourselves. And so I'm not saying don't talk to someone. If you have a very good someone that you know won't be affected by what you say, then talk. But best just one-on-one. Someone who won't be disturbed, and you know they won't be disturbed by you sharing, you know, what you're feeling and what you're going through. It's equally bad not to talk, not bad, but unhealthy not to talk about it if you're finding it hard in yourself. So I can't say the right when, the right where, the right time. If I did, that would be idealization again. And so every day different, every relationship different. And sometimes, you know, you're sitting in a room and somebody walks in and you're, I was just thinking about you. There's something I wanted to say. And there they are. So talk. Sometimes you get an invitation to go and meet daddy or one of the seniors. I was just thinking about, there's something I need to say there. So this is a signal. Share what's in your heart. Absolutely no problem. Yeah. 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 The images that Baba talks about is in the land of symbology. Yeah. If they're just symbols. And symbols are designed to generate meaning. And meaning is dynamic, ever-changing. You create the meaning. If you look at a picture of Lakshmi, you know, you look at that picture, and if you're doing your work, it's like every day you hear the Murli, they're just symbols. If you're doing your work, you hear it differently every time. If you try and hear it the same every time, or see the same image every time, then you're stuck, you're static. You're taking everything literally. Yeah? Instead of symbolically. And if you take things literally, then you're stuck. Yeah, you're stuck on the surface. Whereas symbolically, now what's Baba saying today? I heard this line in the Murli. I've heard it 5 times. Now it's 15 times. But what does it say to me today, according to my current state, where I am, my day to day? What do I read into it, read behind it today? That's spiritual work. If I just take it literally, that's fundamentalist. That's the rigid. Yeah, and so I look at Lakshmi and I see different. I don't personally look at the picture of Lakshmi and say that's what I would like to be. I I hope you don't do that. But everything that's in that picture is a symbol which represents something living, real, dynamic, growing, developing in you. In you. Because the picture's not there, the picture's there. In fact, right now, I'm not here, I'm there. What are you doing with me there? What are you doing with me there? Yeah. Yes. You all get that, don't you? The drama's not out here, the drama's really here. It's here. And right now you're creating it. Do you get that? I'm not here, I'm there. And there and there and there and there. What are you doing with me there? Yeah, it's true. Some of you are going, oh, Mike's fantastic. Other people are going, oh God, I don't know what he's talking about. Oh God. See, I don't know what you're doing. But you're doing that, aren't you? It's not me that's doing that, you're doing that. Yeah. Now if you're very, very aware and you're very connected to your truth, your peace, your heart, if you're aware and connected, you will create me and you will surround me with so much love. Yeah, right. Yeah. In fact, you won't do it just with me, you'll do it with everything. Yeah, you will bring everything to life with so much love. Yeah. Even the worst crime you watch over there, you'll still bring it to life in your consciousness with so much love. Because you're connected to your truth. And love and truth allow you to be in compassion to the suffering of others. Not to be affected by it, to be in a state of compassion. And therefore you create accordingly. Yeah. That's why Jean-Paul Sartre once said, and you'll know this, his famous line is, hell is other people. Feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? But he was wrong. He was wrong, actually. Hell is how you create other people wrongly. Yeah. So, the day you say that heaven is other people, you know you've arrived. So it doesn't matter who comes in front of you, you're able to surround them with so much love. Not there, but here. Then you're in heaven. That's what heaven is. Someone else had their hand up. Yeah. How do I use the image of Brahma Baba? No. Well, my image of Brahma Baba is pretty static because I never met him. And I don't have experience of meeting him in this world, but I've heard so much about him. I've heard so many stories, and so I can construct kind of a slightly dynamic image. And as I hear the stories from the daddies and the seniors and those who knew him, then I build a picture which has more meaning increasingly as time goes on. And so that's how I use him, really. Yeah. I'm not someone who feels that I'm sitting somewhere and Brahma Baba is sitting right next to me. You know, some people feel like that, and that's fine. That's not been my experience or inspirience, if you like. But some people, they do. They sense that, and it's much more real for them. So it's different for different people. Yeah. Yeah. Do I use his perfection? Yeah. Do I use his perfection as my aim? Or do I use his perfection as a role model? Again, it's a similar answer. I never experienced that human being in his perfect stage. So I can only take it as a theory given by others. I can speculate on it, and it makes me speculate on what it means to be perfect. And so it said he was perfect. I still have to work out what that means, whether he was or not, if you know what I mean. Do you know what I mean? I still have to work out what that means for me. Yeah. And in other words, if I just take that literally, oh, Brahma Baba was perfect, so we're all going to follow Baba and we'll be perfect too. Yeah, that's to take it literally and not say, well, what does it mean? What is that? You know, what does that feel like? What, you know, what am I doing? How am I responding from my own perfection? I still have to work all that out. And so for me, he's just someone who's done that brilliantly, probably. I wasn't there to see it, but I believe. But I don't know. I don't have that direct. And that's why the daddies do. They have that direct sense of what that was in their lives. But they still also have to work it out for them. Yeah. One of the tensions is always in a spiritual path is this idea of imitation. You know, if you try and imitate someone, then you're avoiding yourself still. You're avoiding doing your own work. And so he's a role model in as much as of what I've heard and how he did it and the little things that he did and the classes he taught and so on. Definitely a role model. But I still have to walk my own path. I still have to walk my own way. Yeah. Fantastic. It's good. So, ego creates emotion, creates disturbance, and stops us from choosing our own feelings, choosing what we're going to feel. So the only way is to be aware, become aware of what you are becoming attached to. And the attachment is never outside, it's always in the mind, on the screen of your mind, what you create in your mind. You go into what you create, that becomes your identity in that moment. Might just be for a few moments, might be for 50 years. Yeah. And so am I aware of what I'm identifying with on the screen of my mind? Detachment is coming away, back to the center, out of the mind. This is why Daddy keeps saying, don't think. Don't think. Come away from what's on the mind. Be still in the center. And then you feel your power, you feel your peace. Yeah. So if the image doesn't turn up in reality, that's okay. Or if somebody damages the image you have outside, then you're not disturbed because you're detached from that image inside. So you're not disturbed. You don't lose your peace. No emotion, no anger. It's gone. It's gone. Fantastic. Let's finish. I can sense there's an image of food on your mind. So let's have a few minutes of quietness to finish off. Om Shanti.